the headlines. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi repeats Tehran's call for the formation of an all-inclusive government in Afghanistan. France recalls its envoys to the U.S. and Australia and blasts the U.K. after Canberra ditched an arms deal with Paris in favor of an alliance with Washington and London. And the U.S. Capitol is on high alert on the eve of a rally by former President Donald Trump's supporters, who stormed the Capitol building 8 months ago. Thanks for joining us. Iran and Tajikistan have called for the formation of an all-inclusive government in Afghanistan in the wake of the Taliban takeover of that country last month. The presidents of the two countries issued the call during a joint press conference in the Tajik capital, Dushanbe. Iran's Ebrahim Raisi said that a government comprised of one political or ethnic group cannot resolve problems in the country. He also said that terrorist groups in Afghanistan must be taken out, as they pose a threat to the whole region. The Tajik president, Emomali Rahman, said that peace and stability should be restored in the war-stricken nation for the sake of regional security. He warned that an escalation of violence could lead to humanitarian disaster for Afghanistan and turn it into a hub for terrorism in the region. Munir Ahmad is a senior journalist and political analyst who joins us from Islamabad. Welcome. When you take a look at this government that Afghanistan has formed, the Taliban, it's not an all-inclusive government and there are calls for it to be one. The Taliban has responded by saying this could be just an interim political makeup, so to speak. How do you view the way that this government is formed and the Taliban's response?
Thank you very much. Initially, we were expecting that the Taliban, as they were giving their intentions to form an inclusive government, but end of the day, we saw that they have excluded all the factions and all the ethnic groups from the government. And they call it, this is the interim government, but we believe that it is not the interim setup, but this would continue, and this is the beginning of their long-term regime. And they will not have a very inclusive government, and most of the geopolitical analysts believe like their takeover to all over Afghanistan was well scripted, and the present interim government is also scripted. I think Taliban should take their own decision, and they should not follow the script if they really want to have good relations with the neighborhood. And of course, everyone in the neighborhood is interested to strengthen Taliban government. But the internal politics it depends on different factions and ethnic groups. And only Taliban cannot rule it with all a peaceful future. And recently we have also seen like different bomb blasts over there and security issues. They also promised to give rights to women, and they would have a right to education, and they have right to their work, but they have started imposing a different sort of restrictions on their population, and their intentions are very clear, and they have no measures taken to include different factions. And what they have spoken to China, Iran, Turkey, and Pakistan, and unfortunately, at the moment we see, they are not fulfilling their commitments or what they have said to take care of with the neighborhood and bilateral and multilateral relations within the region. So this would create more chaos and more frustration among the other factions. And once like it is now clear their takeover to their takeover of Afghanistan was very much scripted, that and how the United States of America had given space to them to take over, and now with the a notion coming from America that there is the fears of rise of Al-Qaeda. It means like an other script is on the way. So giving all the situation, if Afghanistan and the regional countries like to have peace in the region and stable Afghanistan, Taliban should take care of all the notions. They are coming from the neighborhood because everyone is interested to strengthen Taliban regime. But if it is inclusive, it would have synergy of all the political factions and all the support from a neighborhood, including Iran, Pakistan, China, and Turkey, and Russia as well. So if they exclude their factions internally, external support would definitely diminish, and it would decrease the possibilities of their success within Afghanistan. Yes, please.
Okay, thank you very much for that. We do appreciate it. That is Munir Ahmad, senior journalist and political analyst there from Islamabad. Many thanks. Moving on, the U.S. military admits a drone strike that it carried out late last month in Afghanistan killed civilians and not Daesh terrorists.
It is further my assessment that the strike team were convinced at the time of the strike that the area was clear of civilians and that they had taken prudent steps in regards to weaponizing the strike to minimize the potential for civilian casualties. Finally, it is my assessment that they did believe, as reported, that there was a secondary explosion. Our investigation now concludes that the strike was a tragic mistake.
General McKenzie said that the U.S. intelligence had, quote, reasonable certainty that the suspected location was a Daesh position where terrorists were planning an attack on Kabul Airport. McKenzie put the death toll from the airstrike at 10, including 7 children. The U.S. had said that it was retaliating against the deadly August 26 bombing of the airport. The attack, which was claimed by Daesh, killed over 180 people, including 13 American service members. The strike came as Afghan and foreign nationals were rushing to leave Afghanistan. Activist and commentator Sarah Flounders says the U.S. made no mention of reparations for killing civilians in Afghanistan.
It's come through when the whole world already knows, and knows it through photo and images and visits and interviews. However, it says nothing about the literally hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians who've been killed in U.S. wars. No mention of reparations. Instead, how to further starve down the people of Afghanistan through sanctions, through cutting off every ounce of funds, through taking Afghanistan's own money and leaving them penniless without food as winter is coming on. So this is cruelty and terror in an organized way, and they've been forced to concede that this last drone attack was a mistake. But we should be clear that already it's been admitted that 8 out of 10 of U.S. drone attacks, and there have been more than 14,000 U.S. drone attacks, Hellfire missiles fired, 8 out of 10 of them are mistakes.
France has recalled its ambassadors to the U.S. and Australia amid anger over Canberra's new security pact with Washington and London that scrapped a submarine deal with Paris. The French foreign minister says that President Emmanuel Macron recalled the envoys due to the exceptional seriousness of the recent event. Washington has regretted Paris's decision, saying that it will try to resolve the differences in the coming days. Meanwhile, a French diplomatic source has criticized London for acting in a, quote, opportunistic manner. The row followed Australia's announcement on Thursday that it would ditch a deal to buy French submarines worth $40 billion in favor of a new arrangement with the U.S. and the U.K. to acquire nuclear-powered submarines, dubbed AUKUS. France had already called the abandonment of the deal a stab in the back. The U.S. Capitol is on high alert on the eve of a rally by former President Donald Trump's supporters who stormed the Capitol building 8 months ago.
There have been some threats of violence associated with the events for tomorrow, and we have a strong plan in place to ensure that it remains peaceful, and that if violence does occur, that we can stop it as quickly as possible. We're not going to tolerate violence, and we will not tolerate criminal behavior of any kind.
Police expressed concern about the possibility of counter-protesters making it to the pro-Trump rally. Security forces have reinstalled the fence that surrounded the Capitol for 6 months after the January unrest. The National Guard is also on alert. Protesters say that the rally is on behalf of people arrested during the unrest on charges other than violence against the police and the destruction of property. January 6th saw thousands of Trump supporters, including white supremacists, storm Congress building to impede Joe Biden's confirmation as president. Five people were killed and some 600 arrested during the violence. The United States has imposed sanctions on several individuals and entities linked to the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah and Iran. The U.S. Treasury Department said it is designating Lebanon and Kuwait-based financial conduits that fund Hezbollah. It also targeted alleged financial facilitators and front companies that support the resistance group and the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. Hong Kong-based companies and individuals residing in China were among those sanctioned. The U.S. deems Hezbollah to be a terrorist group. It has sanctioned several Hezbollah members, including its leader and deputy leader. Hezbollah Chief Said Hassan Nasrallah has dismissed the sanctions, saying that the U.S. will not be able to harm the resistance. Political commentator Ramiro Funes says that Hezbollah and Iran have been at the forefront of fighting real terrorists who have been spreading chaos and extremism in the region.
Hezbollah and the Lebanese resistance is by no means a terrorist group. In fact, Hezbollah and Iran have been at the forefront of defeating the real terrorists in the region in the Middle East, ISIS, Daesh, United States, Israel. These are the real terroristic forces in the Middle East. And this is why in Lebanon, in Iraq, in Yemen, in Iran, the anti-imperialist resistance has been growing, the axis of resistance. And these are the brave men and women who have been on the front lines against the real terrorists who have been spreading chaos and extremism in the region. And this is pure hypocrisy because Hezbollah, Iran, Daesh, Hezbollah, and the Lebanese resistance, they have a common enemy with the U.S., which is terrorism, which is extremism. And to brand Hezbollah as a terrorist group, to sanction individuals for supporting a heroic anti-imperialist struggle, is just pure hypocrisy. So I think on many fronts, this just represents the overall double standards of U.S. empire.
International Organization for Migration has expressed concern over the disappearance of thousands of Europe-bound migrants were intercepted and returned to Libya. The UN body spokesperson, Safa Shelly, said that more than 24,000 migrants have been intercepted by Libyan coast guards this year so far. She added, however, only 6,000 have been accounted for in the country's official detention centers. She said the whereabouts of thousands of others remain unknown, saying that they might be subject to trafficking or extortion for release. Libya has long been a hub for African and Middle Eastern migrants fleeing war and poverty in their countries. Those returned to shore are taken to Libya's government-run detention centers, where they are often held in miserable conditions facing abuse. Algeria's former president Abdelaziz Bouteflika has died at the age of 84. He served as president for almost 20 years, from 1999 until his resignation in 2019. Afterwards, he spent the rest of his days in a medicalized residence in a suburb of Algiers. During the Algerian War for Independence from France in the 1950s, he served as a member of Algeria's National Liberation Front. After Algeria gained its independence, Bouteflika served as the Minister of Foreign Affairs from 1963 to 1979. He also served as President of the UN General Assembly during the 1974-75 session. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas warns Israel about the consequences of its crimes against Palestinians held in the regime's prisons. Hamas vowed to liberate the Palestinian inmates recaptured after escaping from Israel's Gilboa prison. It said the inmates will be part of any exchange deal in the future. The movement described the Gilboa prison break the latest in a series of failures suffered by Israel's security, military, and political system. On September the 6th, six Palestinian inmates fled the high-security prison through a hole reportedly dug with a spoon. The later rearrest of four of the inmates sparked protests across the occupied territories in solidarity with Palestinians held in Israeli prisons. The regime has toughened the restrictions on Palestinian inmates and their families since the jailbreak. In India, hate crime incidents against Muslims are increasing at an alarming pace. From industrialists to small business owners to even hawkers, none is spared. Our correspondent Munawar Zaman has more.
One of the world's largest democracies, and on the wall of the parliament, which represent democracy, There is a sentence which reads, Vasudeva Kutumbakam. It means the world is one family, and this is considered the most important moral value of the Indian society. But this is apparently not the case anymore, considering the growing discord in the society. In recent months, attacks against Muslim hawkers have come under the spotlight in social media. Critics say hate crimes against Muslims increased after the emergence of the Hindu nationalist government of the ruling BJP.
In India, from over close to a decade, the Muslim poor community is being further marginalized. This is being done by boycotting the Muslim hawkers and small Muslim traders.
Experts say in India, the political notion has changed from a strong secular nation to a theocratic Hindu nation, which has given rise to violence against Muslims. Now, Hindu extremists have been busy running this show through social media. Experts say the country, which is apparently known as the world's largest democracy, is under grave danger of losing this title. In a nation of diverse ethnic and religious groups, now even beggars are being humiliated and intimidated just because of their faith and are asked to leave the country since they are Muslims. Based on reports by several rights groups, since the ruling BJP came to power in 2014, it has adopted various laws and taken actions that legitimize discrimination against the religious minorities and stigmatize critics of the government. Experts believe it could lead to instability in the world's most populous nation.
Everything is being done to further marginalize Muslims, including hate speeches, hate crimes, mob lynching, the citizenship law, criminalizing divorce, etc. Now they are picking on traders and vendors to weaken the Muslim community economically.
The ruling party of the Prime Minister Modi has fervently denied any discrimination against the community, saying India is a democracy and believes in equal rights for all. But critics say Prime Minister Modi's slogan of everyone together, development for all, and everyone's trust is nothing but a political tool to appease the voters as usual. Munawwar Zaman, New Delhi.
And that does it for World News.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight. The
recent Kabul drone strike received an unusual amount of attention and scrutiny because it happened shortly after the bombing at the airport and because the Biden administration made a point of touting the airstrike as a success in preventing a second attack on U.S. forces at Kabul airport. However, as the subsequent investigations have proven, the people killed in the airstrike had nothing to do with the local Daesh affiliate or any other terrorist organization. We're prepared for you an article written by Daniel Larrison, a contributing editor and weekly columnist for antiwar.com website. The piece is titled Shut Down the Drone War. The 29th of August U.S. drone strike in Kabul that killed 10 Afghan civilians, including 7 children, demonstrates the bankruptcy of the so-called war on terror. Like many other drone strikes, the strike in Kabul targeted innocent people and achieved nothing except to blow up civilians that had the misfortune to be in the vicinity. According to 2 recent investigative reports in the New York Times and the Washington Post, the vehicle targeted in the airstrike carried no explosives whatsoever, and the car's driver was Zamari Ahmadi, an aid worker who had spent the day delivering water to those in need. Hailed as a righteous strike by the U.S. General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Kabul drone strike was an atrocity that should never have happened. The Biden administration has emphasized that the U.S. possesses over-the-horizon capabilities to continue waging war in Afghanistan even after the withdrawal of U.S. occupation forces from the country. But the 29th of August airstrike shows why the U.S. should not be using them. The recent Kabul strike received an unusual amount of attention and scrutiny because it happened shortly after the bombing of the airport and because the Biden administration made a point of touting the strike as a success in preventing a second attack on U.S. forces. However, as the subsequent investigations have proven, the people killed in the airstrike had nothing to do with the local Daesh affiliate or any other terrorist organization. As Ahmadi's brother, Amal, told the New York Times, "All of them were innocent. You say he was Daesh, but he actually worked for the Americans." The U.S. military has defended the airstrike, but all of their specific claims fall apart under scrutiny. U.S. officials claim there was a secondary explosion that proves the explosives were present in the car, but according to investigative reports, no such second explosion occurred. The objects that they believed to be explosives were in fact water containers. Despite surveying Ahmadi for 8 hours on that day, they managed to get every important detail wrong about what he was doing, who he was with, and what he was transporting. The killing of these 10 innocent people is an outrage, but the bigger outrage is that this strike is not an outlier. Things like this have been happening in Afghanistan as well as in other countries for years, but they have received little or no attention. When these attacks take place in remote areas, as they often do, it is difficult for investigators and journalists to determine what really happened. Because this strike occurred in a major city, there were lots of witnesses and journalists could piece together the evidence much more easily. Who knows how many other innocent people have been targeted in the same way that Zamari Ahmadi was? How many people have been executed like this simply for going about their daily business? Who seriously believes that this has anything to do with the security of the United States? Thanks to Daniel Hale's whistleblowing, we now know that the U.S. drone warfare frequently kills civilians, and in some cases, most or all of the victims are actually civilians. As Daniel Hale has said, with drone warfare, sometimes 9 out of 10 people killed are innocent. Many of the people targeted by drone strikes are not necessarily even militants, but just happen to be military-age males. Because the military wrongly assumes that everyone killed in an airstrike is an enemy combatant, unless proven otherwise, the number of civilians killed by US drone strikes is bound to be considerably higher than the government acknowledges. The US military has actually made a habit of either not counting or undercounting the civilian victims of US airstrikes and drone strikes. The US-led bombing campaign against Daesh in Iraq killed many thousands of innocent civilians, but the military acknowledged only a very small number of these. Asmat Khan and Anand Gopal reported in 2017, we found that 1 in 5 of the coalition airstrikes we identified resulted in civilian deaths, a rate more than 31 times that acknowledged by the coalition. It is at such a distance from official claims that, in terms of civilian deaths, this may be the least transparent war in recent American history. U.S. airstrikes in Somalia have killed dozens of civilians, but U.S. AFRICOM Command has acknowledged only 5. The Kabul airstrike fits into this pattern. 10 people were killed, but the U.S. military owned up only to killing 3 adults. Drone strikes have served as the background noise of U.S. warfare for the last decade and a half, and as such, they are mostly ignored until they cause enough loss of life to register briefly on the radar of Western media outlets. The drone war has continued across 4 administrations, and in recent years, the conduct of that war and the casualties that it has caused have been increasingly difficult to track. If Americans had a clearer view of who the victims of drone strikes really are, more of us would realize that the drone war needs to be shut down. It is not making the US any safer, and even if it were doing so at the margins, it comes at an unacceptably high price in terms of innocent lives lost. No government has the right to do what ours did to these 10 people in Afghanistan. And there is no justification for continuing a policy that regularly results in such slaughter.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of information.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. Tajikistan's capital, Dushanbe, is hosting another summit of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. The bloc, which was founded 20 years ago, is a rapidly expanding Eurasian security and economic body led by Russia and China. It has now officially given Iran full membership in this edition of Spotlight. We'll discuss the different aspects of this unanimous decision as well as the significance of such a bloc known as the Alliance of the East at the time of growing tensions with the West.
Heads of State Summit is being held in the Tajik capital, Dushanbe.
Since its foundation 20 years ago, the Eurasian Bloc has defined itself as a multilateral organization concentrated on fighting terrorism and extremism, ensuring regional peace and stability, and increasing economic cooperation. The SCO is the largest regional organization in the world in terms of population and territorial coverage. It is home to almost half of the world's population, and its members own nearly a quarter of the global GDP. In the words of the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, SCO is a leading player in regional diplomacy with firm commitments to inclusive multilateralism.
The SCO is a leading player in regional diplomacy, promoting multilateralism and fostering cooperation to address the most pressing peace and security issues in Eurasia. The organization represents the largest combined population of any regional grouping in the world, over 3 billion women and men, more than half of them children and young people.
The SCO members have made significant achievements over the past years in different fields. In 2021, the foreign trade volume of the bloc reached $6.6 trillion, which is 100 times as much as it was 20 years ago. The total economic value of the bloc also stands close to $20 trillion, more than 13 times higher than its initial amount. Moreover, statistics show between 2013 and 2017, the SCO institutions have made great contributions to the global fight against terrorism by preventing hundreds of crimes and arresting thousands of members of terrorist organizations. The successful interaction of the bloc's members has even resulted in the creation of a political term, the Shanghai Spirit, a concept that highlights the association's main principles: decision-making based on mutual respect, equal dialogue, and consideration of the interests of all member states. These principles have paved the way for the development of the organization and the expansion of its influence to such an extent that today, at the time of growing unilateralism across the world, one can consider the SCO a success story of coexistence of diverse states with different ethnic and cultural traditions.
Well, joining us on Spotlight, we have John Roth, Senior Fellow at the Chongyang Institute for Financial Studies. And also joining us from Potsdam, Germany, we have Harley Schlanger, who is a member of the Board of Directors of the Schiller Institute.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Ross in London. How significant is the full membership of Iran to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization?
Oh, I think it's very significant, because what this means is that it extends the geographical extent of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization into West Asia, and it means that it covers a much, much greater geographical distance. So this is now a very solid region of support and stability in the world against terrorism, against pressure by the United States, and against all sorts of threats. So this is a very significant positive development.
Mr. Schlanger, over to you in Potsdam. Iran's membership at the SCO, what are the implications for Iran across the board, economically, diplomatically, and et cetera?
Well, it has profound implications in all areas, including the counterterrorism. But the, I think the one I'd like to focus on is the economic and diplomatic, because part of what was discussed at the SCO meeting today was how to deal with the situation, the deteriorating humanitarian situation in Afghanistan. And the fact that you have most of Afghanistan's neighbors there talking about cooperation, about economic development, not about punishing the country that's already been punished by literally 40 years of war, but the fact that Iran is being included in this is a recognition of the role that Iran can play as part of a stabilizing force in a part of the world that has been subject to destabilization over and over in the recent period.
Mr. Ross, the Iranian president has promised a more comprehensive, quote-unquote, look to the east. This seems to be a step in that direction, isn't it, in your opinion?
Well, yes, certainly. What is happening, you have, see two processes which are overlapping. Iran, what the way it expresses it is look to the east. That is against the type of unilateral sanctions and threats which have come from the United States and which unfortunately have not been resisted enough by Europe. Europe doesn't go on along with it enough, but nevertheless, unfortunately, hasn't been resisted. And you have then the Belt and Road Initiative, which has come from China, or which is going westwards from China. So, and the two are meeting in the middle. So therefore, you have the coming together of a combined vision, which is coming out of Iran, coming out of China, and coming out of other countries in there. Then that means also that you have certainly very strongly counter terrorist efforts, etc., coming out of Russia and other countries in the region, so you've got a serious force for stability in a very large part of the world. So this is very good news, both economically and diplomatically, and also for any fight against terrorism. And I agree very much with after the situation in Afghanistan, where the United States has just suffered a catastrophic result, and this will help to stabilize the situation, with Iran entering into this alliance which goes across the whole region.
Mr. Schlanger, in his remarks, the Iranian president, Mr. Raisi, asserted that Iran, his country's foreign policy is based on opposition to unilateralism, expressing hope that the SCO will become a driving force of global multilateralism. Can you unpack those comments for us, please?
Sure. I mean, what we've seen since the fall of the Soviet Union is the belief among especially Western leaders, largely in NATO, the United Kingdom, and the United States, the belief that the West won the war, and the idea of a rules-based order, which we hear from Secretary of State Blinken all the time, is that the West now makes the rules. Now, these are rules not about peace and stability, but about economic policy, about who can do what. You know, the idea of a rules-based order that tolerates the kinds of wars that have been launched unilaterally, for example, against Libya, against Iraq, against Syria, defending the terrorists in Syria. This is what unilateralism means, the idea that the so-called winners can assert the policy. Now, on the other side, the idea of multilateralism is find means of mutually beneficial cooperation. This is what Xi Jinping of China means by win-win, that you operate on the principle that other nations, instead of competing over scarce resources, work together to develop new kinds of development projects, which is the basis for peace. And I think the important thing is that one of the other things about the SCO is that in collaboration with institutions such as the Asian Development Bank, the China Development Bank, the BRICS Bank, you actually are beginning to put together a certain amount of seed capital to fund these kinds of projects that are the basis of peace, again, based on multilateralism, not unilateral dictates.
Mr. Ross, as a bloc, how do you perceive the functionality of the SCO? What can it do for the region?
Well, the most fundamental question of the SCO is what you might call military political. That's its origins. That is, it's to get rid of any forms of aggression, to get rid of terrorism, and to get rid of unilateral actions by countries outside. Now, within that framework, then it's possible to build economic relations. One will hope that will happen. Certainly the fact that all the countries in the bloc are against unilateral US economic sanctions is helpful. So it's the most fundamental is that it's a geopolitical military bloc, but it then contains certain important potentials economically, and in particular it goes against the sanctions which are going against Iran. So the fact that it's been admitted into the bloc, which is clearly against the wishes of the United States, shows the solidarity of the other countries within the region against Iran, which will aid regional stability, and hopefully the economic purposes will also develop further within that.
Mr. Schellinger, President Raisi also said, quote, today world peace and security are threatened by hegemony and challenges such as terrorism, extremism, and separatism. Those are some of the issues that you mentioned as well. He also said maintaining and strengthening peace across Asia is not a choice, but a necessity. Does an organization like the SCO fall into bringing about that necessity?
Oh, sure. I mean, because if you look at some of the outstanding issues besides Afghanistan, you have two members, India and Pakistan, both nuclear armed and often at odds with each other. The India-China relationship has not been so good in recent years. However, they share a common interest in economic development of their countries, and importantly, in the idea of sovereignty, which fits in with this question of non-interference of other countries. The SCO has made a big point of this, that there should not be interference in the internal affairs, and that their negotiations and discussions and diplomacy is to enhance the kind of agreements that will allow sovereign nations to work together for mutual benefit. And I think that's really the key to security. What we learned from Afghanistan is that you can't bring peace by war. I don't know if that's been fully understood by the military-industrial complex in the United States, which seems to be itching for a confrontation either with Russia or China. But I think the fact that you have this kind of broad alliance that the SCO represents is an impediment to the unilateral demands or unilateral dreams of the restoring the old geopolitical empire of the Anglo-Americans.
Right. Well, Mr. Ross, a guest that we spoke to earlier here on Press TV on the same issue had this to say. He said we could be seeing the dawn of a new phase of unity in the Eurasian region, specifically with the ugly exit of the U.S. from Afghanistan. Do you see it in that light as well?
Well, I think Afghanistan shows that the policy of the United States over the last 20 years or more has been a total failure. I mean, what has happened in Afghanistan, as is widely pointed out, is that the United States invaded. It spent $2.3 trillion to get rid of the Taliban, and the Taliban is back in power. You can regard that either as a good or a bad thing, but it's a total failure of the policy of the United States. Therefore, what the SCO is based on is the exact opposite of that, which is you cannot remake a country from outside that by interference in its internal affairs. This is a disastrous failure of the United States. It produces either defeat, as in Afghanistan, or it reduces chaos, as an example is developed in Libya. So therefore, that's one of the most important things of the SCO. Though doubtless these countries will have various problems and differences and so on and so forth, but they are not subject to the type of fundamentally destabilizing projects which affect the whole of the world, as we've seen with the situation in the United States' intervention in various countries in the region. That's why the SCO is very, very important region. It's a very, very large area of the world in which you don't have this type of intervention, or which is against this type of intervention by the United States.
Right. Mr. Schellinger, you mentioned the issue of sanctions earlier. The Iranian president called the sanctions a big challenge to the world today, saying that domineering states have been using them as a tool to impose their will over others. He also added the sanctions are preventing regional cooperation and urged the SCO to define mechanisms to fight these challenges. How can an organization like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization tackle these challenges, for example, the unilateral sanctions?
Well, let's take one specific example, the so-called Caesar sanctions that have been imposed against Syria. These sanctions say not only that individuals will be hit with financial penalties and seizure of accounts and so on, but that any nation or company that engages in reconstruction in Syria will be penalized to the full extent of the law. Now, that's a violation of every human rights ordinance that is on the books. Now, what can something like the SCO do? Well, you have a question now where the U.S. is imposing these sanctions on Syria. At the same time, it's occupying the oil fields and a lot of the wheat-growing area, and the people of Syria are suffering badly. The Russians did something interesting. They started a means of bringing in food. We just saw the other day the Iranians bring oil to Lebanon. When you have countries that have a commitment to work together, they can find ways to do this. Now, what's the recourse that the sanction imposer can do? Go to war? I mean, at this point, as Professor Ross just pointed out, wars don't work to do this. All they do is destroy. So I think that the ability to get together and work out through discussion process a way of economic cooperation and collaboration is a way around the sanctions. And it will create immediately a confrontation, but that's the kind of confrontation that's necessary because I think at this point, the recourse to war is something that even in the United States, the American people don't want more wars.
Mr. Ross, President Raisi, he condemned the U.S. for causing chaos in the region, particularly in Iraq and Afghanistan. He said Washington needs to be able to account for what it has done in Afghanistan over the past two decades. Also in clear opposition to foreign interference, he stressed that the sole way to establishing security in the region is through regional cooperation. Here, we can insert the SCO, a.k.a. The Alliance of the East. Tell us more.
Well, but this is obviously correct. I mean, look at the record of the United States interventions. What have you produced? You had invasion of Iraq. This produced total destruction in Iraq and previously very marginal terrorist organizations instead became very powerful. If you look at the situation in Afghanistan, the United States intervened. It spent $2.3 trillion, according to the best estimates, as a result of which is that it was actually military defeated. In Libya, which used to be the richest, most prosperous country in Africa, you now have the open selling of human slaves in Libya and economic chaos. What has this produced? This has produced absolutely catastrophic results. And it just shows that you cannot interfere from outside another country's affairs. Countries have their internal equilibrium, their internal forces. Sometimes mistakes will be made. No country in the world is perfect. But the intervention from the outside, invariably, as shown by the United States, produces absolutely disastrous results. And the SCO is against this and is the main regional bulwark of stability in a very large part of the world. Therefore, the inclusion of Iran in this is a very positive situation. Unfortunately, despite these disasters which have occurred with US policy, it is not at all clear that they've learned this lesson. But then the SCO is a powerful bulwark against this type of disaster being foisted on the world. And of course, these types of negative effects they're bad enough, most worse, for the countries in which they occur, but then they also lead to the spread of international terrorism and other things which can destabilize whole regions. This whole policy by the United States has been absolutely disastrous.
Mr. Schlanger, final comments on the issue. The Iranian president stressed that the sole way to establishing security in the region is through regional cooperation. How big of a role can the SCO, which is also known as the Alliance of the East, play in such an equation?
Well, it can play a huge role. I mean, first of all, the whole world needs development. We're teetering on a global financial disaster, economic collapse, again, coming from the same unilateralist policies. The role of the International Monetary Fund to suppress development. the idea to justify intervention under something like Tony Blair's responsibility to protect has been a disaster. Now, what happens when you get powerful nations such as Russia and China, and I would include Iran in that, which has a very important role to play. What happens when those nations show that you can work together? You can overcome disagreements through dialogue, but you can act in concert for the development of the people that are in your neighborhood. And that's initially what the SCO was set out to do, to take a situation that was somewhat chaotic in the region around the collapse of the Soviet Union and bring stability. Now, where was the terrorism coming from? A lot of it was from the outside. And by working together, you create an environment of trust. And that's something that's totally lacking. And just very quickly, what the US and the UK did with the submarine deal with Australia shattered the trust of many in Europe that they could work with the United Kingdom and the United States. So I think the example that can be set by the SCO will have a powerful effect on the whole world.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Let's leave it there. Thanks to my guest, John Ross, Senior Fellow at the Chongyang Institute for Financial Studies, joining us from London. And thanks to Harley Schlanger, member of the Board of Directors at the Schiller Institute, speaking to us from Potsdam, Germany. Also, thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu to your listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host Musa al-Bahadili coming to you from your program Q&A on Islamic beliefs. Joining us in the studio today is our dear friend Sheikh Murtada Karim, who is a researcher at the Islamic Seminary of Qom. Dear Sheikh, I welcome you and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sheikh. Today's discussion is a continuation of the previous session's topic about why the name of Imam Ali alayhi salam is not present in the Quran. Dear Sheikh, you mentioned some points that I will just summarize them very briefly, and then you can, of course, expand on them. We said even if the name of the Imam was written in the book, they would have found a way to either remove his name, ignore his name, or rewrite the Quran. And we said that's impossible to happen. Allah prevents that from happening because in the Quran he says that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is a protector of the Quran, which is why our Quran has not changed for the last 1,400 years. So even if the Imam's name was there, it wouldn't have made a difference, or in worst case scenario, he just has changed his name. So please continue the discussion, dear Sheikh.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As I mentioned, Some people argue that if the names were mentioned in the Quran, then there was not any kind of disunity among Muslims, Shia and Sunni, and debates and fights in some cases.
Right.
But we said that it could have happened through naming the names of the first three caliphs too. If the names of the caliphs were mentioned in the Quran, then there was not any kind of difference among the Muslims. So we asked the same question. Also, as I said in the previous program, some people argue that had the name of Imam alayhi salam been mentioned in the Quran, there was no room for disunity among Muslims, because it was not likely for the companions of the Prophet to act against the explicit text of the Quran. But I mentioned that the historical reports, both in Shia and Sunni sources, tell us that in various occasions, the companions of the Prophet in general and the caliphs in particular, they acted against explicit verses of the Quran.
Right.
I talked about one example, and that was about the inheritance of the Prophet. The first two caliphs, they negated any inheritance from the Prophet for his daughter Fatima al-Zahra salamun alayha. But as I mentioned, there are two verses in the Quran referring to the fact that the prophets also leave inheritance for their family members.
So even if his name was in the Quran, they can just find a way to not look at it or acknowledge
exactly,
it.
Exactly, to bring a fake narration to remove,
right.
Not to act upon that verse. The other verse which they acted against is the 41st verse of chapter Al-Anfal, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم وأعلم أنما غنمتم من شيء فأن لله خمسه وللرسول ولذي القربى. This verse is talking about one of the Islamic obligations, that is of khums, one-fifth. The fact that one-fifth of the according to Sunni understanding, the booties of the war, and according to Shia understanding, whatever we earn at the end of 1 year of our properties, one-fifth of that should be given to the Imam of the time or his deputy.
Right.
But anyway, according to this verse, even if we understand it from a Sunni perspective, one-fifth of the ghanaim should be given to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, فَأَنَّ لِلَّهِ خُمُسَهُ وَلِلْرَسُولِ وَلِلْقُرْبَةِ to the Prophet and his family members.
Right.
The history tells us that Abu Bakr abandoned paying khums to Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayha and other family members of other members of the Ahlul Bayt, and which was against the explicit text of the Quran, the verse that I recited, chapter Al-Anfal, verse 41.
And this also continued because also the caliphs and their followers didn't anymore pay khums to the household of the Prophet.
Exactly.
They just gave it to the caliph himself.
Exactly, and other companions. When it comes to temporary marriage or mut'at al-nisa, chapter al-nisa verse 24 explicitly refers to that, فَمَسْتَمْتَعْتُمْ بِهِ مِنْهُنَّ فَآتُهُنَّ أُجُورَهُنَّ. No one can claim that this verse is referring to permanent marriage. There are arguments for that. But the second caliph explicitly said that this mut'ah was permitted at the time of the Prophet, and I announced it forbidden.
Right.
So he acted against this verse of the Quran.
And in doing so, of course, unleashed a whole wave of sin that we are still troubled by
exactly.
today.
Exactly, we are still troubled. And the same person, the second caliph, he also abandoned what we call it mut'atul hajj, or hajj al-tamattu. We know that Baqarah chapter 2 verse 196 reads, فَمَنْ تَمَتَّعَ بِالْعُمْرَةِ إِلَى الْحَجِ. And according to all the scholars, or the majority of the scholars, it is referring to this type of hajj, that is, hajj al-tamattu. But again, the second caliph, there is a famous narration that he says, mut'atan, there were two mut'ah permitted at the time of the Prophet. One of them is mut'atul nisa, and the other is mut'atul hajj, hajj al-tamattu. But I announce both of them to be forbidden. So he's acting explicitly against these two verses of the Quran. And also we have in chapter An-Najm,